let me tell you what we're going to do tonight, if we can. We've gone through the posting of the colors, the prayer, and we thought Colby did a great job on the pledge. Thank you, Colby, for doing that. We have some introductions to make tonight. We've got District Judge Steve Smith is here. Steve, are you here? By the way, when I announce your name, go ahead and stand up, and we'll hold the applause till the end for all of them. We've got County Judge Dwayne Peters. Dwayne, are you here? I know you're here. There you are. We've got Sheriff Chris Kirk, Commissioner Kenny Mallard. We've got Commissioner Lloyd Wasserman, Constable Rick Starnes. Rick, where are you? There's Rick. We've got Constable Jeff Reeves. We've got College Station City Councilman Carl Mooney. Carl. And we've got Chancellor John Sharp and his wife are here tonight, Charlotte. So let's give a round of applause for all of them. In terms of the staff that we have, I can't do this job by myself, as most of you know. And so we have a staff of people that help us out to take care of things in Washington, D.C., and representing my office in Washington, D.C., include Jeff Morehouse. Jeff is chief of staff. He's somewhere back in the back. And then Andre Castro, who takes care of communications for me, is here. Locally, here in the district, we have 8 persons that work in 3 offices in Waco, Bryan College Station, and Cleburne. I'm glad to have our district director, Edward Getterman, with us tonight. Our deputy district director, James Edge, is with us, who is here in the Bryan College Station office. We've got Andrew Gordon, who's a senior field representative in the Waco office, is with us. Diane Williams is a field representative and also the person who runs the office in Cleburne. And then we've got Miranda Henderson, who works here in the Bryan College Station office, that takes care of constituent services, casework, and grant applications. So they are the team that help us get things done. So I'd like to give them a round of applause. If you don't mind. One of the things that we're blessed to have, given the fact that we represent 2 great schools, Texas A&M and Baylor, is we've got a continuing stream of interns that come through, and they are the people that really do all the heavy lifting when it comes to getting things done. We've got 2 of our local Texas A&M interns with us tonight. We've got Madison Fox and Jessica Harrison. You probably saw them out in front when you were here. Also, we've got some volunteers. We've got Ryan Davenport, who is here as a volunteer to help us with this town hall this evening. And his friend, Nicole Heath, is also with us, and they're both Aggies as well. So we thank all of them for being with us tonight. We'd like to do a couple of things, but we need to thank the folks at the Bush Library and at Texas A&M University for allowing us to have this at this facility, so let's give them a round of applause. Also, the Earl Graham American Legion Post, thank you for your help tonight. So. And then we can have this representative republic and this ability to have these conversations because of the service and sacrifices, not only of our military men and women, but of our local first responders. And they're here to keep us all safe, so we're protected from threats abroad and also at home. Because of our military and our first responders. So thank you for the first responders for being here tonight, local law enforcement. So. We've got some special recognitions tonight. I try to recognize every uniformed person who has lost their life in the service of our country. During the time that I've been in office, and we've lost 7 military men and women since I've been elected. The most recent tragedy was Lieutenant Colonel Roy Tisdale. Lieutenant Colonel Roy Tisdale grew up in Alvin, Texas. He went to Texas A&M, where he was a member of the Corps. After graduating from A&M in 1993, he was commissioned as an Army and Infantry officer. He served 2 full tours in Iraq, 2 full tours in Afghanistan, and he made additional short visits to both theaters. At the time of his death, Lieutenant Colonel Tisdale was the commander of the 525th Brigade Special Troops Battalion, 525th Battlefield Surveillance Brigade, stationed in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. We've got some special guests here tonight. His mother, Linda Tisdale, is with us, who lives here in the district, and his brother, Charles Chet Tisdale, is with us. Each time we lose one of these individuals, one of these heroes, I go on the House floor and I talk about them. And so that makes it on the congressional record. And so we're going to give them, we're going to give each of Linda and Chet a copy of the congressional record as well as a flag that we had flown over the Capitol. So Linda and Chet, if y'all would come up. The everybody knows them. The we lost Lieutenant Colonel Tisdale on June the 28th, and then I think we were reminded again of the fragileness of a human life, and also the sacrifice of men and women who put their uniform on every day. Some of them put on the uniform of our country. Some of them put on the uniform of our local law enforcement agencies. We lost another one. We lost Brian Bachman in the line of duty, and we are here to give flags and congressional records to each of his wife, Donna, and their sons, their children, Sam, Amanda, Colby, and Caitlin. I believe just Colby and Caitlin are here tonight, right? And Brad and Carmen, Donna's parents. Brian's parents, and then Donna's parents are here as well, I believe. So get all of y'all to come up. Also, on the day that we had the service for Brian, we also flew two flags over the United States Capitol, and this is one of the flags, and this is for the Martin Luther King. Fitting to me that, given that we lost one of the own of our community, of our law enforcement community, that we should recognize the sacrifice that the community made as a whole. And so I'm going to ask Dwayne Peters, county judge, to join me up here on the stage. We're going to give Brazos County, and this is not just for Brazos County, but this is essentially for the College Station first responders and also for the city of Bryan first responders. But we're giving this the same congressional record certificate and flag to the senior most ranking individual in Brazos County for them to keep in recognition of Brian's service and sacrifice, as well as all of our first responders in Brazos County and this community. So I want to thank each of you for recognizing these special friends of ours and for recognizing the service and sacrifice of not only our nationally uniformed personnel, but also our local uniformed personnel. With that, let's go on to the next part of the program. This is what we want to talk about tonight. We want to talk about jobs and the economy. We're going to talk about federal deficits. We're going to talk about taxes. We're going to talk about healthcare alternatives, American energy security. I'm hoping if I can talk fast, we'll get through that in about 20 minutes. I'm going to try to be quicker if I can. Then we'll have questions and answers, and then our goal is to wrap up. We'll stay as late as we have to, but our goal is to wrap up, to be respectful of your time, to wrap up around 7:15 to 7:30 or so. I've got a couple of other announcements I'd like to make at the end, and then we'll also talk about how to stay involved as we close. Guidelines, as we go through, many of you may have submitted questions when you walked in the door into the box. If you think of a question during the course of our presentation tonight, write it down and be prepared to turn it in, if you would, and so you can get all your questions in. In essence, what we're going to try to do is limit everybody to one question per person. I know some of you may have 100 questions, but let's try to pick out the most important question you'd like to ask and bring that up. You know, if you've got another question that's important, give it to your neighbor to turn it in, have them turn it in. As Ben said, he's going to try to sort the questions so that we don't have multiple questions on the same topic. So in some cases, he may have to mash a couple of similar questions together to come up with a common question. And then the thing I'd like to remind everybody, we're here to have a conversation, so let's please be respectful of each other. The rule I use in terms of Facebook posts and everything else, if you wouldn't say it to your grandmother, don't say it here. Or if you wouldn't do it in front of your grandmother, don't say it here. This is what I've been trying to do in Congress. I've been trying to follow the Constitution, put Americans back in control of their budget, of their government, develop Main Street solutions, not Washington solutions, to build a strong economy, to help our job creators, to control Washington's spending spree, thank you, balance the budget, reform the budget process, achieve real American energy security, fix Washington's broken political system, that may take a while, and restore accountability in Washington. Now, this is why I ran for Congress. This is our granddaughter, Britton Grace Flores, back on March the 25th when she turned one. What I want her to do is have the same America that our forefathers gave to us. How many of you think America's on the wrong track? So a bunch of you. How many of you think that your children will be worse off than you? Almost everybody. How many of you are concerned about the federal budget and our national debt? And how many of you are concerned about energy security? Okay. We want this young lady, as well as your children and grandchildren, to not have those concerns. But like in a perfect world, for that, all of your hands to be down when those questions are answered. And we want them to have a world of opportunity. In terms of jobs and the economy, we still have the worst unemployment crisis since the Great Depression. We've had a general lowering of wages. We're going to see that in a minute. Manufacturing employment has fallen in the past 3 years. It fell just last month by 15,000 jobs. The average time it is taking to an unemployed worker to find a job is the longest in history. Half of recent college graduates are homeless. One in two people. Jobless, I'm sorry. Not homeless yet. Not homeless soon enough, I guess. They're not out of appearance home soon enough. This is a staggering statistic. The ranks of poverty have grown dramatically during this recession. And now almost one in two of what used to be in the middle, one in two Americans are considered to be lower income or poverty. And the middle class is falling at a rapid rate into this new category. About 49 million Americans. And when I say one in two, we mean one in two of the middle class. More Americans than ever are now on food stamps, and businesses are suffocating under mounds of red tape. Now, when it comes to young America, this is pretty interesting. The youngest have been hit hardest by this economy. These are recent surveys. 54% of recent college graduates are jobless or unemployed. And in the next bar chart down there, 85% of college graduates expect to move home. I guess they're not homeless, so that takes care of that. But look at what's happening to their starting salaries. The median high starting salary for a high school graduate has gone down by $2,000 for men, and is down by $600 for women. College graduates are down about $2,400 for men, and women are down by about $1,700. Now, in terms of some questions that were asked among this age group, 82% think it's going to be harder to find a job. 75% think it's harder to save for the future. 71% think it's harder to pay for college. And 69% think it's harder to buy a home. Looking forward, we're not out of the woods yet. And we still have some headwinds coming up. Under the health care, the implementation of the health care law, according to the Congressional Budget Office, and these aren't Bill Flores numbers, the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan part of the Congress. We asked them to score things and tell us about the economic impact and the cost on the federal budget. They estimate that the implementation of that, now that it's been held to be constitutional by the Supreme Court, is going to cost 800,000 jobs. The defense sequester that's going to kick in on January the 1st is going to cost 2.1 million jobs, according to a George Mason University study. And then there are various, we all know that tax increases are going to kick in without congressional action on January the 1st. The House has passed a bill that says that those tax increases will be put off for a year while we come up with a scheme for comprehensive pro-growth tax reform. On the other hand, if we do nothing, then the numbers of jobs lost as the economy is going to slow down, according to the CBO, are north of a million jobs. The Senate and the has proposed a tax increase on just higher income workers. The president has endorsed that. That will cost us 710,000 jobs, according to an Ernst & Young study. So we're looking at 3.6 million jobs in terms of additional potential economic headwinds. They're going to kick in beginning around January the 1st. Now, what's the solution to that? I don't want to just throw out the problems. I want to talk about the solution. The House has passed several bills. We call it the Plan for America's Job Creators. I carry it on a card by pocket. And it's on the back of it, we've got 30-plus bills that we passed. And what do these things do? They remove the burdensome regulatory government requirements that are being imposed on business today. And when I say remove, I don't mean remove back to 1950 or 70. I'm talking about rolling back to where we were in about 2006, 2008, not back to the beginning of time. So if you hear somebody say that we want to destroy the environment, just let them know that what the truth is. We want to promote tax reform for economic growth. We're going to go into what that looks like in a minute. We need to get Washington smaller in order to do that. Washington's got to spend less, and we do that by controlling its spending. We need to promote an all-above energy approach to American energy security. If you think about it, American energy security is a national security issue. In order to have a robust national security, you need to have a robust economy to be able to pay for it. And in order to be able to have a robust economy, you need to be able to have your national energy security. And if you think about it, truly great countries are the ones that can grow their own food and their own fiber and their own fuel. And we are in the process of we haven't been able to do it in the fuel area, in the energy area, for quite a while. We're rapidly having some problems in the food and fiber areas as we go forward. Now, these bills I was telling you about on this card, here they are. I just wanted to tell you where they are, that we have passed them, and now they're parked over in the Senate. Moving to fiscal issues for a minute, this is what scares me to death. This is what keeps me awake at night. This is one of the principal reasons I'm in Congress. You hear about the federal deficit each year of about $1 trillion to $1.3 trillion. And that sounds scary, and it should, because it's a disaster. People get worried about our total national debt of $16 trillion. You should be worried about it, but there's more. In addition to that $16 trillion of direct debt that we borrowed from somebody, typically from the Chinese, you've got another $10 to $12 trillion that represents the unfunded portion of Social Security. And then you've got another $70 to $80 trillion that represents the unfunded portion of Medicare. And then you've got another $10 to $12 trillion of other, whether it's the Civil Service Retirement Plan, which is underfunded by about $600 billion, or if it's military retirement or veterans benefits, whatever. You add it all together, and you come up with about $105 to $115 trillion of total obligations for the federal government. And as you can see from this chart, it grows dramatically. So from 2009 to 2010, that total grew from $63 trillion to $76 trillion to $99 trillion to what I was talking about today of about $105 trillion. Every year we're adding over $20 trillion. And where is that going to go? If you think about that picture we showed you earlier, that's going to go back on the backs of our kids and grandkids. And so this is what happens by waiting. It grows and grows, and it will get to the point where it'll be hard to turn it around. If you think about it in sort of practical terms, if you have $105 trillion of total obligations and the total GDP of the country is $15 trillion, that's equivalent to having a $50,000 salary and a $350,000 mortgage. You know it doesn't work. And so we've got to fix these. And we can find a way to fix it where we can preserve and protect Social Security and Medicare, not only for today's retirees, but for future generations as well. That's the reason it's so important to address these issues. Now, there are a couple of plans I'm going to show you about the ways to deal with the debts and deficit. Right here is the time period. Each year, the president is supposed to submit a budget by mid-February, and then Congress is supposed to pass a budget. The president has given us a budget each of the 2 years that I've been in Congress. This year's budget was particularly fascinating to me because he sort of stabilized the deficit here for about 10 years at 80% of GDP. But then it explodes. Now, one of the assumptions in here that they assumed in order to keep it down to 80% of GDP is that the economy was going to grow, the GDP was going to grow by 4% per year. And we know recently that GDP has been growing at a rate of about 1.5% to 1.8%. So we're already losing ground in this time frame right here. But then we do nothing. There was nothing in this budget in here for that 10-year period to address any entitlement. There was nothing to look at the Simpson-Bowles Commission recommendations to address entitlements. Whether you like them or not, they were not addressed at all. And so this debt explodes. And it goes to something off the charts. I asked Secretary of Treasury Geithner, I said, let's assume for a minute that your granddaughter has been appointed to be Secretary of the Treasury right out here. What are you going to tell her about, A, what did you do to fix this? And B, how should she finance this mess that you've left in her lap? He didn't have a very good answer for it. Now, there are solutions. I've worked with Paul Ryan. Well, I wanted to be on the budget committee. As a CPA, I'm drawn to be inclined to look at numbers. And I wanted to try to fix the federal debt. So Paul Ryan brought in 10 freshmen to help him, and most of us came from the real world. We had run businesses or had owned businesses, and so we knew that your income's got to be equal to your outgo. And so we passed two Path to Prosperity budgets for fiscal 12 and fiscal 13, and they lay out an honest assessment of our country's finances. They didn't pull the wool over anybody's eyes. They laid out that. They preserved and protected Medicare. They fixed Medicaid. They reformed our welfare programs. They reduced discretionary spending. They included pro-growth tax reform. As with any business that's in trouble, there's two things you've got to fix. You've got to stop the spending. You also have to grow your income. We want to grow our federal income. We do it by growing the economy so that you have more work, people working, more people having paychecks, and more people paying taxes in. And so that's what we did. We also wanted to strengthen national security by addressing the sequester that passed last summer. And most importantly, we wanted to restore economic opportunity for future generations. In addition to that, one of the things that's been a particular problem for me is the way that our federal budget process works. It is full of gimmicks, full of accounting gimmicks. And so we've come up with a package of 10 to 12 different bills that we want to pass for budget reform. And for instance, one of them that I'm a co-sponsor of is No Budget, No Pay. Now, back to the budgets we... If you think about it, here the House for 2 years has been honest with the American people, laid out how big the problem is, and came up with a solution to fix it. The Senate hadn't passed a budget in 3.5 years. And so, if we're, we ought to do what, some of you have read the thing that goes around that's attributed to Warren Buffett, the 28th Amendment, fix the deficit by saying you can't run for re-election until you fix the deficit or things like that. I don't care what it takes, but Congress needs to pass a budget and get real with the American people about how to address this issue. And so we've got things like, instead of doing our budgeting based off a baseline, go to zero-based budgeting so you rebuild the base, the budget of the government every year from zero. And then use real-world economics. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office works within an antiquated set of rules. It assumes that if you lower taxes, you have less tax revenue coming in. But we've seen, and history proves us wrong on that. They assume that if you raise taxes, that you get more tax, that you raise rates, that you get more economic activity. What we've seen is you can actually have less economic activity depending on how you do it. And so we've tried to reform that to go to dynamic scoring instead of static scoring. And I'm not going to go through everything. In terms of federal deficits, here are the solutions. We can fix the defense sequester. We passed cut, cap, and balance in the House last year, which is to cut federal spending down to 20% of GDP, cut it immediately down to lower rates, something between around 2008 levels, then to cap it at 20% of GDP, and then ultimately balance it along with a balanced budget amendment. Unfortunately, we didn't pass the balanced budget amendment. It takes two-thirds to pass the House, and it didn't pass, unfortunately. There are several TARP programs that were not fully funded, and they were failing, and so we were able to eliminate those before the money got sent out the door and wasted. We passed two full repeals of the health care law, along with a bunch of other bills to try to nibble around the edges to keep the health care law from being such an imposition on the economy. We're reducing spending for the health care law. We've got a ban on earmarks, which is held firm. And then congressional budgets were reduced by 10% over the course of the last few years. Last year, in my first year in Congress, I turned back about 22% of my members' representational allowance. I was shooting for 40 since we're having to borrow 40 cents on every dollar. But it's a little tough, but we did turn back 22%. Now, this is what shows you the stark choices that we have. Here is what happens if we do nothing. This is the current path that we're on. The path to prosperity budgets, well, you'll see an increase in debt for the short term for the first 4 or 5 years, and then you begin to see federal debt stabilize here and then begin to go down where it's ultimately paid off. That's what we did in the two path to prosperity budgets that we passed. This is the way that, and this is not Bill Flores' numbers, this is the way the Congressional Budget Office and the Office of Management and Budget, the two primary scorekeepers for the Congress and for the President, track what we've done. And this, I can ask you this, which future do you want for your kids and grandkids, the green one? I think so. On taxes, I'm going to go through this quick. Everybody knows tax rates go up on January the 1st, 2013. A family of four earning about $50,000 is going to pay about $2,200 in more taxes. The death tax will be increased by rates as high as 55%. The lowest bracket that we have today of 10% is going to be eliminated. That raises the lowest rate to 15%. So those tax increases that happen on January the 1st without further change are going to hit some of the lower income folks the hardest. The White House and the Senate have proposed a tax hike on job creators. It will cost 710,000 jobs. 57,000 of those are right here in Texas. It affects 940,000 American businesses. It raises about $6 billion. We spend that in hours in the federal government. It doesn't address. We lose jobs, and then we don't address the deficit. In terms of economic policies, hang on just a minute. Sorry. Okay, I went too fast. In terms of the rhetoric that you hear coming out of Washington about taxes, you've heard us say in the third quarter of 2009, when we were still knee-deep in the recession, we had 1.4% economic growth on GDP. We heard a quote, you don't raise taxes in the middle of a recession. And then we get here to late in 2010. This was in the lame duck session right after I got elected, but before I got sworn in, when current tax rates were extended for another 2 years, where economic growth was coming up a little bit, still pretty slow, but coming up a little bit. The lame duck Congress and the President passed and signed an extension of current tax rates with rates here. Today we've got economic growth back down to 1.5%, and we want to raise taxes. Now we think it's okay to raise taxes on job creators. We all know that that's not a good thing to do. In terms of solutions, we did pass, in addition to passing a short-term extension for 1 year of current tax rates to extend them through the end of 2013, we passed the Job Protection and Recession Prevention Act to do that. Then we passed a second bill called the Pathway to Job Creation through a simpler, fairer tax code, and that allows us to reform our tax system. We want to take corporate taxes from 35% down to 25% and go from a worldwide taxation system to a territorial taxation system so that you're only taxed on what you earn here in the United States. We will go from being the least competitive country from a tax perspective to being the most competitive. And then to make sure that things are done fairly, we strip out the loopholes and deductions so that some companies get more credit for doing some things than other companies. Again, so that no matter what your business is, whether you're into manufacturing cars or into the local dry cleaning store, to oil and gas, to wind energy generation, you're gonna have the same deductions and incentives that everybody else has. You'll have a flat system so that when you make an economic decision to make an investment, you don't care about taxes. You care about the economic returns that you're gonna have, and you know your taxes are gonna be the same as every other industry in the country. In terms of American energy security, we all know the price of gasoline is going up. The federal government has, while that's gone up and there are common sense things we could do, the folks in Washington have given money to companies like Solyndra, and now Solyndra's got a bunch of brothers and sisters. And collectively, those brothers and Solyndra and its new siblings have squandered about $2 billion in hardworking taxpayer money. Meanwhile, while we did that, Gulf of Mexico output has gone down by 17% by the end of next year. And production from taxpayer-owned land, this is public land that you and I own as taxpayers, has gone down by 11% just last year alone. Let me give you another idea. This is our idea of American energy security coming out of Washington. You know, we could have the Keystone Pipeline bring oil from a friendly country, Canada, down to the Gulf Coast, refine that in U.S. refineries, and help create thousands of jobs in the process, have better energy security, and have lower gasoline prices. But for reasons that still escape me, we've got people that think we should only approve this part here and not the rest of it. Now, in Congress, we passed at least three pieces of legislation to approve the Keystone Pipeline and move down the road. Now, what should an energy solution look like? It should increase electric generation from nuclear power. If you really want to have the ultimate green fuel, then as these coal plants begin to reach the ends of their respective lives, we ought to have nuclear-powered electricity, nuclear-generated electricity, ready to come online as those coal plants come on. And we will have better energy security at lower cost and a cleaner environment all at one time. And we ought to have about 80% of our baseload electricity produced that way. We need to reduce EPA red tape. If you go out here to the electric plant that we get our power from, that comes from the coal-fired plant out of Carlos, and have them tell you what the avalanche of EPA regulations looks like. And then talk to them about what the emissions of that plant were when it was built in the 70s versus what it is today. And you'll be amazed at how much we've done to clean up the environment at a fairly modest cost. But then talk to them about what it takes to go get that last 1 or 2% of the emission stream and how much it costs and what it'll do to electric rates and what it'll do to jobs in this country. We want to utilize, we got to have conservation, but to me the conservation is driven by the consumer. You go to the type of light bulb you have when you want to go to it, not when the federal government. So if you want to go to the little curly ones that are CFLs, or you're going to do like I did and go to LEDs, you do it when you're ready to do it. If you want to drive a Prius, fine. If you want to drive a Bolt, that's fine. But you make the decisions on how you conserve. We need to continue pushing for the Keystone XL pipeline approval. And then we also need to look at alternatives. This is something Gene and I produce from our house, more solar-generated electricity than any other home in Brazos County, Texas. So I'm into this stuff. I'm a geek, but I could afford it. We don't want to impose that on everybody. And so there's some scientist working here at A&M that's going to come up with a new solar panel that's 50% efficient instead of 11% efficient. And we shouldn't be hurting his or her research, by subsidizing with your taxpayer money the stuff that doesn't work today. So let the market drive the solutions. Let the technology drive the solutions, not the federal government be picking what the alternatives ought to look like. Okay. A 100 years ago, 98% of this country's power came from carbon, whether it was coal or oil or gas. Today, 100 years later, it's about 95%. And so I agree with everybody else. We need to move away from having a carbon-based energy stream. But we're not going to do it tomorrow. So what any part of this involves using that carbon-based energy that we have that's indigenous to this country today, while we develop the solutions to bring that down, it may only be 2% per decade. But don't try to do it like that, because you impose these huge economic dislocations that put people out of work. And so I think there's a way to do this. This is what the all-of-the-above approach looks like for American energy security. Healthcare. All right. Since the President's healthcare law has been approved, let's talk about what it does. This is a diagram of what the new healthcare bureaucracy will look like. Now, so you've been dealing with your doctor or your healthcare provider, and you and your family, and sometimes with an insurance company. If you have VA care, you deal with VA. If you have Medicare, you deal with Medicare, with HHS. Now let's add this to the picture. A whole bunch of new bureaucrats between you and your doctor. Our goal in healthcare reform is to improve access to healthcare, high quality healthcare, and to lower cost as we do it. We don't want, and we can't do that with a big government solution, in my view. For instance, we've got this little dot here called the IPAB. Does anybody know what the IPAB is? Okay. The IPAB is the Independent Payment Advisory Board. 15 unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats, none of whom can have any medical experience, that are going to make every decision with respect to how much your provider gets paid and what services you get as a patient. 15 unelected. Think of the guy sitting in the hot tub, worked at the GSA, making your health care decisions. That's the way you need to think about it. This is the way you need to talk about it with your friends and neighbors. Everybody thinks, yeah, well, the federal government needs to get involved. But think about the federal government. Who's the federal government? It's predominantly bureaucrats that have no skin in the game. You have skin as a patient. Your doctor has skin in the game as a provider. These folks don't. This is not the way we're going to improve health care. Here are the alternatives. And I need to hurry up. I'm going too long. We voted 33 times to repeal, defund, dismantle parts of health care. Let me tell you what health care ought to have, health care reform ought to have as we go forward. It ought to have medical malpractice reform. We spend about 300 to $400 billion a year in extra testing and litigation protection in this country, or just in paying for lawsuits. And we can stop that through medical malpractice reform like we have here in Texas. It worked in Texas. It can work in the rest of the country. Whether you buy health insurance as an individual or as a family or as get it through your employer, the tax treatment ought to be the same across all of them. We ought to allow individuals, small businesses, trade associations, small employers to band together to form associations to buy health care coverage. We ought to be able to allow them to do it across state lines. We need to reduce waste, fraud, abuse. We've seen a bunch of that in Medicare. And then we've got to come up with common sense solutions to cover people with pre-existing conditions. Now, here's where things get a little more interesting. What I mean by common sense solutions? In other words, what I mean is somebody who is in a situation to not have health care coverage through no fault of their own, and suddenly they wind up with a condition that they can't get covered in the future when they do get the ability to buy coverage. I feel like we ought to be able to put them in a position to get that condition covered. Versus, let's say, Joe down here, who has had the opportunity to buy health care coverage his entire life and has decided not to do it for whatever reason. Then he gets sick and says, okay, you need to cover me. Why should everybody in this room pay for the cost of that person's bad decisions? That's like buying car insurance after you've had the wreck. And we know that doesn't work. So we need to come up. Now, I don't have the perfect answer for that. I just know we've got to come up with a solution for it. And a lot of these solutions are going to be done by taking the federal government out of it, not putting them deeper into it. I mean, if you think about it, our Constitution doesn't say anywhere in here that it's supposed to provide health care coverage. A lot of people think it's a right. Think about the people that were crossing the Mississippi River going to California to mine for gold in 1849. Did they have a right to health care coverage? Doesn't mean we can't try to help it happen, but we've got to make sure the private sector and the consumer work together to make it happen and let the federal government facilitate it how it can by removing barriers or enabling people to do things from a tax perspective. Okay, finally to the reason we're here tonight, and that's to get your questions. And so, Ben, do you have some questions already? Okay. Okay.
We do have, as you said, we do have a lot of questions and a lot of things that have been multiple. I have just eight on one question. But I've tried to kind of brighten the card here. We'll start with the easy ones first. Quantitative easing 3, are you against it or for it? Do you think it will be harmful to your
society? Can we hear you? Ben, can you repeat that? May have to. Look, you're an old radio guy. You ought to be able to get through this.
Okay, there we go. Actually, there's about $500 an hour worth of people back in the back who are making sure you can hear me. So, what's your feeling about quantitative easing 3? Are you against it? Are you in favor of it? And what's your position?
I am against quantitative easing 3, or QE3 as it's called. First of all, I don't think it's going to work, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Secondly, is it really does set up a foreboding situation for our future, for future inflation, and so I'm against QE3. Now, on the other hand, one of the things you need to think about, if you go back and read what Chairman Bernanke said, normally you wouldn't have the Federal Reserve taking any kind of action this close to an election because it makes it look political. I'm going to assume for a moment that he wasn't doing anything political. I just said I was. I didn't say I was right. But if you read the testimony of what he said, of the report, the Federal Reserve is scared to death of the economy. And the economic headwinds that we have, I hope you've come away with, if nothing else, from this town hall meeting, the fact that most of the economic headwinds that we have are coming out of Washington. Whether it's the lady who owns the dry cleaning store here who would like to open a second location who's scared to death to do it because she doesn't know what her power is going to cost, what her health care is going to cost, or what new OSHA person is going to come and slap her across the face with a fine, or because she doesn't know what new EPA regulation is going to come out, to a larger company that's trying to figure out how much to spend at the Carlos Power Plant because they don't know what the rules are going to be. Because of that, people are sitting on the sideline, and they are not investing in people or property, plant, and equipment. They're just not investing. So the Federal Reserve is to try to be the adult in the room and say, well, somebody's got to do something. Now, I'd say that I think the House of Representatives has done a pretty good job with the Jobs Act that we passed. But here's what's going to happen. In order for, when the Federal Reserve makes a quantitative decision or to put money in the economy, in the past, what's happened is they put money in the economy, and then it gets invested a few times, and then you get increased economic activity out the other end. In an environment where you have uncertainty among the people that make the investment decisions, the money goes into the economy, and then it winds up in financial assets instead of hard assets or into people. And so you get no change in economic activity, but you get a huge growth in the monetary base, and you set yourself up for inflation somewhere down the road. And so I don't think it's going to work. The first QE1 and QE2, I think, had some impact. But I don't know how many of you talk to business men and women every day like I do. But I think at this point in time, the uncertainty has gotten bigger among the job creators. And so as a result of that, I think QE3 is going to have a low impact. I think you saw the stock market go up, but you didn't hear Exxon say, well, I'm going to suddenly invest more money. You didn't hear your neighbor that owns a dry cleaning store say, oh, now, happy days are here again. I'm going to build a new dry cleaning store. So I don't think it'll work. I'm sorry for a long answer or a short question, but we got into a little money in banking there, and I wanted to make sure we were on the same page.
All right, I think we're very interested in so I'll ask again. One of the purposes of that is on income tax simplification, and do you think the Republican Party has failed to endorse and campaign properly for the fair tax?
Okay, two questions there. The first question regarding tax simplification, in August, right before we broke for recess, actually last week of July, we passed a blueprint for what tax simplification would look like. I told you what it would be like for corporations, go from 35% to 25%, go to a territorial tax system from a worldwide system. That will bring tons of jobs and corporate headquarters back to this country. And then on the individual side, you go from 6 tax brackets that go all the way up to 40% to down to 2 of just 10% and 25%. And then you have dramatic simplification in terms of deductions and credits and so forth. So the tax system gets a lot fairer, a lot flatter. And at the end of the day, those two things, according to independent analyses that we had done, will increase our rate of GDP growth by about 1.5% per year, about 1.5 million jobs per year, just from tax reform. I'm not talking about from all the other things we could do. Now, the ultimate solution, I think, and this is me going out on a limb, is to get away from the income tax-based system. I think we need to go to something akin to the fair tax. Well, I think we need to go to the fair tax, and I have co-sponsored the fair tax. Now, but I don't think we ought to do it today. Now, here's why. If you think about the what I laid out for you, we've got all this uncertainty among job creators. And if we start talking about a transition from income taxes to fair taxes, what are you going to do? You're going to make a decision, do I buy now, do I buy later? If you're in business, you're going to make a decision, do I invest now, do I invest later, and pretty soon you've taken the level of uncertainty, which is already high, and you've made it higher. So my view on this is, let's enact comprehensive income tax reform that's based on pro-growth principles, like Ronald Reagan did in the 86 Tax Reform Act. And then, after the economy is settled down and growing again, and the level of uncertainty in the business community is down, then let's phase in the fair tax. Let's make sure that we do it properly. Congress is really good at coming up with phase-ins that don't work well. And these unintended consequences come out. So do it where the fair tax kicks in over 5 years or 10 years, and the income tax goes down by the same rate over that 5 or 10 year period. And be sure you put a bullet in the head of the income tax at the end of that time period. So, and that way, I think that if we do that, then I think consumers and businesses can adjust in a more logical time frame. But let's get the economy healed before we start implementing the fare tax.
If we can't get our financial house in order here, why aren't we still sending money to other countries? We have to say, no, we just can't do it at this time.
Right. I didn't fully answer that last question. Somebody said, have the Republicans done enough to promote the fare tax? No. I think that's probably a fair answer that my party hasn't. And I think the reason is if it gets too big a head of steam today and then suddenly winds up getting put into law, that it causes that additional uncertainty. Now, there is one guy that is a freshman with me, Rob Woodall from Georgia, who wears a fare tax down on the House floor every day, and he's eat up with it. So he's ready to go right now. So if he were to answer the question, he'd say, "Yeah, I'm out there promoting it every day." So I don't think we have, but at the end of the day, I think we need to not introduce another level of uncertainty. Let's get the economy fixed, and then you'll hear me promoting fare tax as much as anything else we've talked about tonight. So back to the question.
Why should we give money to authority?
We should not give people give money to people that don't like us. By the way, let me have. How many of you think otherwise? Okay. Anyway, and I want to say two things about foreign aid. How many of you think we can balance the federal budget if we stopped all foreign aid and cut out waste, fraud, and abuse? Okay, this is smart crap. See, but most of America thinks differently than you do. Most America thinks that if you cut foreign aid to zero and cut out waste, fraud, and abuse, you can balance the federal budget. I think most of us in this room know that you could take the $1.3 trillion of discretionary spending that we're going to spend next year, $1.2 trillion actually, and turn it to zero. You just balance the budget, but you don't have a military left. You don't have any research to fund basic research here, any research dollars to fund basic research here at A&M. You don't have some of the basic blocking and tackling things that part of our government does fairly well. And so you've got to address the big elephants in the room in order to balance the budget, and that's Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid. And that's what our Path to Prosperity budgets did. Now, for those of you that are concerned about Libya, foreign aid and foreign aid to Egypt, those have been frozen. One of the things, we've got a very powerful lady here in Texas named Kay Granger, and she is, and I didn't realize this, I knew she was powerful, but I didn't realize how powerful till last week. But she is the subcommittee chair for foreign operations on the Appropriations Committee, and they dole out the money. They have the way thing, money is appropriated. Before it can be spent, the State Department has to come say, we want to spend so much money in Libya to do this, or we want to forgive $1 billion worth of debt to Egypt or whatever. They have to come to her, and she can say yes or no, or whether or not it's even go to the committee. And she has said, no, we're freezing Libyan aid, and we're not going to forgive the $1 billion to Egypt or $1.5 billion of debt to Egypt and no more debt to Egypt, so, no more aid to Egypt. So I just want to let you know. We took that action last week after the guest. We took that after the events on September the 11th.
This question starts with a listing of three mentally unstable people who committed capital crimes with guns. It says, do you think there's a problem when people like these have unimpeded access to guns and ammunition?
Oh, they gave the names of the people?
Well,
you don't have to name them, but you're just saying,
right.
Like some of our recent.
Think,
okay.
Do you think there is a problem with access to guns and ammunition?
There is a problem with. Let me answer it this way: the Second Amendment gives us the right to keep and bear firearms. I don't think that we ought to do anything to impede the right to keep and bear firearms. Now. If there's a way that you can make sure that mentally unstable people don't have access to firearms, we should do that. We've got to make sure we find the right way to do it that still complies with the Second Amendment. Now, look, I'm a concealed carry license holder. I own guns. I carry guns Not today, but I do. So anything goes wrong, I want all you law enforcement guys down here quick. So anyway, I believe there are right ways to deal with this, but we don't want to weaken the Second Amendment so that Americans lose those valuable Second Amendment rights.
What's your position on Medicare? Do you say you fully endorse the Ryan plan? Do you support your Medicare vouchers?
Well, there's two different questions there. The Ryan plan doesn't have vouchers in it. How many of you think the Ryan plan has vouchers? Okay, a couple of you do. There are no vouchers in the Ryan plan. The Path to Prosperity budget passed by the House does not have vouchers. It has what's called premium support. It has what I have. As a member of Congress, I get a book at the beginning of the year that says, here are the health plans that you can choose from. This is what they cover. These are the out-of-pockets. This is what the government pays, and this is what you pay for you and your family. That is what Medicare would look like for people 54 and younger under the Path to Prosperity budgets. And so you reestablish a relationship between the user of health care and how much the health care costs. Today under Medicare, you have what's called a fee-for-service program. You go to the doctor, you get treated, you don't care what it costs. What you need to do is reestablish the commercial relationship. When I go to the doctor and he tells me I need to have a knee surgery, I say, let's talk about it. How much does it cost? What are the options? You know, how much is my insurance going to pay? And so what we've done in the Path to Prosperity budget is reestablish that economic decision so everybody has skin in the game. Let's talk about Medicaid for a minute. We have the same thing with Medicaid. It's a fee-for-service arrangement. You get sick, you go to the doctor, you don't care what doctor you go to. For instance, your kid has a sniffly nose, you go to the emergency room. It costs the taxpayers about $1,000 for that kid to go to the emergency room. What if you did this? What if you said, okay, we recognize that Medicaid needs to ultimately change the behavior of the people who are consuming health care. What if the person who has the snotty-nosed kid says, okay, I have to pay a $5 copay if I go to the 24-hour medical clinic, or I have to pay $75 if I go to the emergency room? Think about that. So the person who has the kid that needs to be treated still gets the treatment, but the cost of the taxpayer is a lot lower because they, as a consumer, need to make an economic decision. And that's what we're trying to do with Medicaid. That's what we're trying to do with Medicare, is to put the patient and the doctor back together and get the government out just as a dispenser of free money, essentially. Okay.
A study from the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service shows no evidence that tax cuts for the highest earners are associated with savings, investment, or productivity growth, but there's evidence that these cuts do increase income inequality. Why would you support tax cuts?
First of all, there are areas where I don't think Congressional Research Service gets it right. The Reagan tax reform. Reagan took the tax rate. We can talk about Reagan. We can talk about the Bush tax cuts. We can talk about any set of tax cuts. We can talk about the Kennedy tax cuts. When John Kennedy got elected, the economy was facing a couple of headwinds. The top marginal tax rate was 93%. And so what did he do? He lowered it to 70%. And we had an immediate burst in economic activity. And we didn't have it just because people may have had more money. If they had more money and just put it in their pocket, then we wouldn't have the economic activity of people reinvesting and growing the economy. The same thing happened when Reagan came in. The top tax rate was still 70% left over from John Kennedy, and he lowered it to 50. Now, he had an extremely difficult economic environment that he had inherited, with high interest rates, higher energy costs, and high unemployment. And when they lowered the rates, we began to have an economic resurgence. And then when tax reform went in, that economic resurgence continued. And it was because people reinvest in property, plant, equipment, and most importantly, in people, putting people to work. You look at the employment numbers, you can almost overlay, not perfectly, but you can almost overlay what the workforce participation is in this country with what the tax rates are. Now, you can't ignore what's going on underneath. You know, for instance, in the Bill Clinton administration, we had a combination of things related to the dot-com boom that was going up that went bust toward the end of his administration that George Bush caught. So tax rates do make an impact. Where are you going to invest in business? Let me put it this way. If you're in California that has a top marginal rate of 50% plus, are you going to invest here in Texas that has a top marginal rate that's only the U.S. tax rate plus what is the sales tax rate? Where are you going to invest? You see it happening with states. We'll see it happening with countries if we can make our tax system much more competitive. Now, what was the other part of the question? There was a second part. Read that again.
It said that the CRS...
Oh, income inequality. I remember. Income inequality. The federal government's role is not to ensure income equality. If you go to the preamble for the Declaration of Independence, it says we're all endowed with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. It doesn't say income equality. If you look at the Constitution, it's supposed to protect those rights that are given to us by our Creator. And it doesn't say we're going to do it by creating a government that figures out what income equality should be. Everybody has equal opportunity. We're not all going to have equal outcomes. I mean, think about it. Why? If I sit in a class and half the class is getting F's and I'm working hard to get an A, should I get a C? I mean, is that fair? That's great equality. So, if people work hard, shouldn't they earn more money? Okay. Y'all answer it for me. Okay.
I would have taken some of those extra points and accounted 209.
You never asked. I'd have sold them.
Education is not an enumerated power that the Constitution gives the federal government. Would you create a plan to abolish this unconstitutional department and put legislation on the table to do that?
Yes, eventually, but not tomorrow. First of all, whoever asked the question is exactly right. There's nothing about education in here. But it's like a lot of things the federal government's gotten into. So it's gotten into it. Has it gotten better? The Department of Education started in the late 70s. How much money have we spent since then? Hundreds of billions of dollars. What's happened to our test scores? What's happened to the outcomes? Has it gotten better? Has it worked? What's the mission of the Department of Education? Has it achieved anything? And so if we go back and start with question number one, okay, is it in here? Question number two, okay, we did it anyway, not we, whoever was there then. But has it worked? What's our goal? Education is a state and local matter. And the farther you get the decision making about a function that affects all of us in this room, away from you, the less accountability you're going to have by the people that are making the decision. If the people in Washington are trying to come up with a common curriculum called Common Core, that common curriculum may not reflect Texas values. It may not reflect Bryan College Station values. It may not reflect what we want to teach our kids right here. And so why should the federal government get involved? Now, it's like all things in government, they started out with great, you know, aspirations. We're going to try to help improve education for everybody. That's the aspirational goal, and if they want to spend money to do that, maybe spending money by giving block grants to the state and say, go ahead and improve your system and come back and tell us how you were accountable with it, and maybe we can say, we can help all the governors get together and form a roundtable and share best practices. But in terms of having an army of bureaucrats in Washington thinking they're going to help things better here, it ain't going to happen. Just think about the guy in the hot tub. some of you work for the government. I don't mean to demean people who work for the government. That's not my goal here. But our goal is to adhere to the Constitution and have, you know, everybody have the rights that are guaranteed to them under this Constitution. But the Department of Education has failed. Same thing with the Department of Energy. It's failed. It hasn't done what it wants to. Now, I'm not saying everything the Department of Energy has done has been bad. The Department of Energy has done some great things right here at Texas A&M through basic research grants. So keep that. If it worked, keep it. It also has done a good job of protecting our nuclear stockpile. Okay, keep that part. But the rest of it, Solyndra, did that work? Enter One, Beacon, the cars that are built in Finland, didn't work. So let's skim down the federal government to those things that are in here. And in the meantime, the test we ought to use, and while we're trying to get toward this, is the ones that don't work, stop them. Sorry, that was a real long answer to a short question. But
so. You voted for raising the debt ceiling last year. I understand you're planning to vote for it again very soon.
That's
why are you doing that?
Well, all right. I did vote to raise the debt ceiling last year, and the reason I voted for to raise the debt ceiling is because of a couple of things. Number one is the amount that we raised the debt ceiling was going to be offset by spending cuts over the next 10 years. Now, I don't like that answer very well. The other thing that it said is that we were going to implement budget reforms by having this so-called select committee get together and decide how we were going to come up with long-term solutions to address our nation's deficit. That failed. If I had to take that vote all over again, I would have voted against the Budget Control Act because of the fact that the select committee failed, because now I know that there are people that really don't want to make this work in Washington. And I'm not talking about the colleagues on my side of the aisle. The thing about, and I don't know, the questioner said, you plan to vote for it again. I don't know who said that, but I don't plan to vote for it again. I will look at another. We talked about the debt ceiling in a Republican conference meeting last week. There actually was a freshman meeting with the Speaker of the House. And we said, what are we going to plan? We're going to have a debt ceiling vote sometime in the lame duck session after the election. And we asked the Speaker Boehner, what is going to be in it this time? We don't want to have another failure like we had in the Budget Control Act. And he said that we'll have spending cuts that are equal or in excess of the debt ceiling increase over a shorter period of time, and our goal will be to get entitlement reform as part of it. Even under the Ryan budget that we passed, or the Path to Prosperity budgets that we passed, federal debt will go up over the next 10 years to about $25 trillion, and then it caps off and it comes back down. That will not be a problem as long as the economy is growing to make the debt look smaller as a percentage of GDP than it is today. So that will work as long as we have a growing economy. So all the pieces have to fit together. You've got to have federal government spending less money. You've got to have regulatory reform so that people feel comfortable reinvesting. You've got to have pro-growth tax reform so that you have a more competitive U.S. economy. All the pieces have to fit. And so if we come up with a debt ceiling increase vote that is, or a proposal that has cuts that are higher than the debt ceiling increase and has budgetary reforms as part of it, I would consider voting for it. And here's the alternative. If you don't do that, then you turn the U.S. economy into a test aircraft. You're taking in places you don't know where it's going to go. You don't know how the rest of the world is going to respond to financing your debt. You don't know the way things work today. The president or the Treasury Department makes all decisions about who gets paid and who doesn't get paid. So you don't know if your military gets paid one week, if Social Security recipients don't get paid the next week, if we're not going to pay air traffic controllers the third week. You don't know how that's going to work. So I think, in my view, what we ought to have in any sort of a debt ceiling vote is let's prioritize the way things are going to be spent. So make your debt service first, pay your military second, pay Social Security next, and then go down from there and figure out how that works. And so I haven't said I'm going to vote for just a clean debt ceiling bill. I'll never vote for a clean debt ceiling bill.
We've got about a little over 10 minutes left, so since we're going into the lightning round, I've saved all the really complex ones.
You want me to talk faster then, right?
Okay. Do you think the Republican Party should try to stop funding for the executive order that gives us a de facto DREAM Act?
Yes, and we have. We have tried to stop funding. We have had riders. The problem is that the way the appropriations process works is the House will pass an appropriations bill. The Senate will pass an appropriations bill. You get together in conference. You agree on what the final appropriations bill is going to be, including policy riders to stop a particular direction the president's wanting to go. And then you pass that in both houses, and then it goes to the president for signature. The Senate has not passed over a handful of regular appropriations bills, but now to do 12 a year. They haven't passed any real, they haven't taken much in the effort to do appropriations bills, so it's pretty hard to do it. We get as many policy riders as we can on continued resolutions to keep the government funded, but we can't attack every problem. For instance, there's another program from the president called Ocean Zoning, where he wants bureaucrats to zone the oceans. I was able to get limitations into our appropriations bills to stop his ability to do that, but the Senate didn't pass the same appropriations bill, so he's free to do it because it can't be stopped, because Congress has not come to a conclusion to defund that activity, even though it's not in this document, and even though Congress has looked at this issue for 8 years and decided to not have the federal government zone the oceans. So I hope you understand how frustrating it is to have somebody just make decisions and do things and to be unable to stop them because the Senate's not on the same page with you.
Here's a general question. What are you going to do, or what are you doing to help Texas A&M students specifically?
Well, if you go back to that chart that had all those unemployed kids, those unemployed young adults, they're not kids, they're unemployed young adults. We want them to have a paycheck. We want them to go to work. And the way we do that is by building a middle-class economy again. And the way you do that is by reducing the size and scope and intrusiveness and the meddlesomeness of the federal government. Because why do you go to school, to Texas A&M or Baylor or any university? You go to get a set of knowledge so that you can get a job and you can have a career. But today it's almost like, why bother? I'm going to get this education, but there's no economy that will take me today. Now, what I want to do is, just like with my granddaughter, I want her and I want all those people that represented the unemployed college graduates and high school graduates to come out and have a job. And the way you do that is by building an economy that will absorb them, that's growing. And it doesn't come from government. It comes from job creators who say, okay, I'm ready to open that second dry cleaning location. Or I'm ready to open a new plant in South Texas to manufacture plastics. That's the way we do it. Look, the best social program in this country is not a Pell Grant. The best social program in the country is a paycheck. A paycheck. You know, the best social program in this country is a paycheck. That's where you feed that family, you educate that family, you house that family, you grow the local tax base, so that you can fund College Station ISD, and you create a vibrant middle class so that you have people paying taxes to be able to fund all the things we want to do in basic research here at Texas A&M, or Pell Grants for people that want to go to school. Look, when I went to school, I put myself through. But I knew when I did it that I was making a good investment because I was going to have a job when I get out the other side. Young people today don't have that same option. That's what I'm hoping to do, is give those young people that same option.
What are you going to do? Do you see a way to avoid the sequestration?
I do. We've actually passed in the House and the House Budget Committee, we use a tool called reconciliation, and we basically said, instead of having this $100 billion in cuts, most of it or half of which will come from defense, let's replace those cuts with cuts from other part of the federal budget. And so we passed reconciliation in the House. We went out and attacked entitlement programs that have exploded. You know, for instance, look at food stamps. Food stamps have gone from 32 billion recipients to 46 billion recipients. Some of those recipients shouldn't be getting them. I'm not going to go into details, but they shouldn't be getting them. And so we looked at programs like that, and we fixed those programs, and we fixed welfare programs and set it up so people could go to work. And so, yeah, we think it can be fixed. We passed reconciliation to fix it. But, again, it's one of the bills that's on this sheet that is in the Senate graveyard. Now, if we don't, it's going to be a real problem.
I mean, if I were Lockheed, I'd be thinking, when did I start sending out the notices of pending layoff?
This one starts out as an enumeration of powers question, but it says, while Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are responsible for the long-term budget deficits that we have, they are very popular. Do you consider them part of the social contract, or would you commit to creating a plan and getting legislation on the table to phase out any program that's not given in the Federal Legislative Powers Act?
The questioner was right. Is Social Security and Medicare are not in this document? Neither is Medicaid. But some of our forefathers created it and dumped it in our laps. And they dumped it in our laps. It was designed badly when it started because it was not intended to ever fully fund the obligations for retirement from people that were then working. It was always set up where you took from one generation and you transferred to another generation. And so what we've got going now with the baby boomers retiring at the rate of 10,000 a day is the biggest intergenerational transfer of wealth this country has ever seen. And it's coming from those young college students and those young high school students that you saw in that graph up there to my generation. And so we've got to find a way to fix that. I don't think it's going to be practical because of the way the population is today to turn it off like that. You know they can't do that. So what you have to do is you have to build a bridge to find a way that's better. And so I don't mean privatize Social Security, but I think you can fix Social Security for about 75 years by doing three things. You can begin to slowly raise the retirement age. Now you'll have to make sure you make adjustments for people that work in blue-collar professions versus white-collar professions. You can change the COLA, and that will not impact people that are on Social Security today. And then you means test it. And you can fix Social Security fairly simply by doing that. It still means the federal government's involved, and that causes me some heartburn to have the federal government involved. But still, it's one of those things you just can't turn. When you say you just can't, it's hard to turn something off like that. And because think about it. If you turn it off, then everybody in this office that turned it off, that represents the same ideals of following the Constitution that you do, gets thrown out of office. And then you have people get put in office that believe that this is not worth the paper it's written on, and they just put in something that's worse. And so if you think about how do you get from point A to the point we want to go, and that's back to strict adherence to this, that may take a couple of generations. It took us a few generations to get here. It may take us a while to get back. You know, so I don't know who asked that question, but you put me on the spot on that one. But no, so again, I'm not going to vote to terminate Social Security tomorrow, but I think we've got to find a long-term fix for it. On the budget this year, I tried to get Paul Ryan to put Social Security on the table so we could fix it. And he said he'd like to, but the speaker came back and said, you know, you've got to remember, folks, this is an election year. You want to have Social Security ads run against you? And I didn't run to be popular. There are others that don't, but I do think Social Security is bankrupt just like the other two big entitlements, Medicare and Medicaid. We're going to have to fix it, and I think we can fix it. It's actually the easiest entitlement to fix, and we can do it without destroying the program. You can protect today's seniors and still protect my granddaughter's ability to have Social Security.
This one goes to process and personal beliefs. Why don't you write legislation for the greater good that will pass both the House and the Senate? Why not compromise to get laws passed?
The compromise work. I'd love to compromise. But folks, I'll ask you, where's the middle ground between food stamps and paychecks? It's pretty hard. We've got a divided Congress. We also have a divided electorate. About half the people in this country are on some sort of federal assistance. They get some sort of check back, some sort of economic assistance. The other half of the people are paying the bills. So where's the middle ground where you can get, if you can find out where the middle ground is to get the population together, you'll get Congress to go to the same place in the middle. But for me, I can't see that place, and so I'm always going to vote for the paycheck solution because, again, I think the paychecks are the best social program that we've got in this country.
And our last question, Congressman. When the Republicans take the Senate and the White House in November. What do you think the first spending cuts or other legislation that we see?
Oh my goodness. That will be the dream battlefield, because what you'll see is Romney's already said what he's going to do. He's going to approve the Keystone Pipeline. He will immediately reverse every executive order that President Obama signed. We will repeal Obamacare. We will replace Obamacare. We will then immediately pass the tax rate extension so that everybody knows their tax rates are at least going to be the same as they are today through the end of 2013. Then we'll start working on pro-growth tax reform. So we'll start to implement the Path to Prosperity budget so we can save Medicare for today's retirees as well as future retirees. My hope would be we'd save Social Security. We'll also take Medicaid. We'll give it back to states so they can deal with their population the way they want to. So there will be a ton of stuff to do. And I've heard rumors about it. I don't know if it's true or not, but I've heard rumors that the Romney-Ryan ticket has a 200-day plan of what they want to accomplish each of those 200 days. I'm not here to be political. I'm just telling you what we do, because, look, we've already done it once. Look, you didn't elect me to Congress to go maintain more of the status quo, to come go get you a bunch of earmarks for the local community. You elected me to go get the federal government off your back, and that's what this stuff does. And so we've already passed it. We've already been beat up by it in the press. We know how to respond to being beat up in the press about these things. And so now let's just go affect it. Let's go implement it. And so we'll reintroduce them, repass the House, have them pass the Senate, and then we'll go on down the road. Now, it won't happen tomorrow, but it'll happen pretty quickly. For instance, to get rid of Obamacare, you've got to use reconciliation. In order to use reconciliation, you've got to get the Senate to pass a budget. Well, that's a little out of practice. So you know, doing that might take until June, but it will happen. But in the meantime, everybody knows it's going to die. And so, you know, businessmen and women are going to say, okay, I can exhale now. I can begin to invest in my business. In people, property, plant, and equipment.
Congressman, we're out of time. I'll save these and give them to your staff to take and respond individually. And thank you very much for your time.
We're not done yet. Hang on just a minute. We're not done. First of all, but we answered all general questions. Everything else is individual.
Well, my understanding is that we have a hard stop time. Senate-sponsored for the National Security and Jobs Protection Act.
I don't know. Yeah. Why don't you run through them real quick? I'll try to be brief. Y'all want to answer a few more questions?
Yes.
Okay, I'll try to be real quick. By the way, is Kyle the Cub Scout here today?
Yes.
Okay, don't leave. Okay. Okay.
All right. The Republican platform talks about protecting farms. What about Union Pacific and the crime problem in Robertson County?
Okay. The UP question. How many of you are here from UP or the UP group? Not from UP, the Brazos Bob group. Okay. Let me tell you this. I'm not familiar with the whole issue. That area is outside of the current District 17. It will be in the new District 17 that, if I'm reelected, that I'll be responsible for in January. I'll tell you what I will do. I will sit down with you. As a group, I will sit down with UP as a company and hear both sides of the story, and then I'll sit down with both of you in the same room. I will tell you this. I don't think you want the federal government involved in that. This is really a state and local matter. On one hand, the people of Robertson County would have $300 million in new investment, and I think some of the school systems could afford that. I mean, would like to have that in the tax base. I don't think the federal government ought to be involved. I think the laws of eminent domain are reasonably well established today, but I will sit down and talk to you. So, but I don't know that you want the federal government to get involved. Okay.
Why don't you use the courts to stop the administration breaking the laws and breaking the constitutions?
I don't have a good answer for that. Let me check into that. I really don't. If it were me, I'd sue the president every day he did an executive order that was outside the scope of the Constitution. But I'm not sure. You've got to have something called standing, and I don't think if you're in Congress you have standing. But I don't know the technical answer to that, so I'll find out.
Are you supporting January funding for cancer research and prevention?
I think I support funding the NIH to help come up to, but to rely on them to allocate how research dollars ought to be spent. Look, to me, under the guise of promoting the general welfare, not providing the general welfare, I think there are some things the federal government does well. When it comes to basic research, the federal government does a pretty good job, because if you think about it, companies and individuals are not going to fund that type of research. That's the reason we're able to do cutting-edge things here at Texas A&M, is because we give them the dollars to do basic research, doing the research where there's no expectation of a financial outcome. And then when we get the good results we want, then it becomes commercialized and the economy gets better and a company is born, for instance. So I think there's a role for the federal government in basic research. Now, I don't want to get into the applied research like we were trying to do with Solyndra and picking venture capital and stuff like that. But I do think there's a role for things like cancer research. But our research programs that are funded by the federal government, for the most part, do work pretty well. I think they allocate their portfolio pretty well. But like everything else in the federal government, they're going to have to get by with less. We really jacked up what they were getting in the 2009-2010 timeframe. We're going to have to go back to more 2006-2008 types of funding levels. And the world didn't come to an end back in those years.
Well, this one is a last question, and it's a good one. Do you believe that the general welfare, interstate commerce, and due process clauses in the Constitution mean what the founders meant, or what the Supreme Court says they mean?
I believe that they mean what the founders meant. So, that's the question. Okay, so we got all the questions.
We're good.
Okay, good. All right, we're going to go through. I've got a few things I want to talk about. This is something I'd like to pay attention to. We've got a congressional veteran commendation. So if you know a veteran in Texas 17 who served their country with a distinction and then have served their community with distinction, please nominate them. There's a place on our website, flores.house.gov, that you can go so that you can nominate a veteran for this commendation. The deadline is October the 12th, and we will award this sometime, Jeff, what, November, December? Okay. So we'll have that coming up. So please, if there's a veteran that you think is deserving, please do that. On a redistricting, I'm just going to spend a second here. The current district we have today, get my map straight, is right here. It starts up here at the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. It's a long scheme district. It goes down to Grimes County. This is the map that we have now. We lose everything north of Waco and McLennan County, and all this is the new District 25, but it's blockier down here, so they packed in the counties more closely. This is really better because it relies on there's a natural alignment, I think, between Waco and McLennan County and Brazos County, Bryan College Station. So these are sort of the barbells, the barbells here. And then it's predominantly outside of those areas, it's predominantly agricultural. So there's a lot of common interest here, except there's a little squiggle that comes over here. This is North Travis County. There's about 130,000 new folks over in North Travis County that we'll have to deal with. The good news is it doesn't include the UT campus. So anyway, if you want to know what my scorecards, the voting scorecards like, there are a lot of people that rate me. Most of the conservative groups give me pretty high marks. Most of the less conservative groups give me pretty low marks. I don't know where I got that 3% on the liberal action score. You can follow us, as I said before, on forest.house.gov. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. If you've got feedback sheets for tonight, please do that. I don't know when we're going to have another town hall. I promised to have three series of town halls per year, one in the north part, one in the central part, and one in the southern part of the district. This is the end of the third series. Depending on what happens in the lame duck session, I may have a fourth series of town hall meetings. Depends on what goes on, because that's when your life can really be hurt in a lame duck session. So we may want to come back and talk to you a little bit if you're interested in hearing what's going on. But again, just kind of stay tuned on that. And then starting over next year, we'll have the next, if I'm reelected, we'll have another series of town hall meetings.